Good morning. Hey, Michael, could you turn these lights on so the old guy can see? Begin with, I need to make a confession or a correction, whichever one you want to call it, of something I said 2 or 3 weeks ago. I had mentioned way back when we started the book of Mark, and I mentioned a couple weeks ago, how that perhaps it was hard to find a time when Jesus actually came back to Jerusalem. Y'all remember that? We talked about how that part of the fact that the Jewish leaders was after him, it seemed like he avoided Jerusalem. And I had challenged you, and I didn't do it myself, but to go through the account of Mark and all the Gospels and kind of look and try to make a map of where Jesus had gone. And I did that for the book of Mark and never found where he went back to Jerusalem at all till now, till we're in the last week of his life. And got to find, looking for a map, and I told you I found a map that all that had been done. Some guy had already traced all the travels of Jesus, and he didn't have him going back to Jerusalem either, and so I assumed that he was right, and I assumed I was right, and told you that. Well, I should have checked the Gospel of John, because Marshall told me after the sermon said, I think there's another time when Jesus cleansed the temple besides the time we're talking about now, and he was in Jerusalem, and he told me it's in John 2. So I looked in John 2, and sure enough it was, and I looked in John 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or whatever it was, kind of glancing through, and Jesus was in Jerusalem several times, so forget what I said a few weeks ago. He was there for at least several times. Usually it was a feast day of some sort, and probably even every Passover probably went there. So get that out of the way. We're in Mark chapter 11. We'll be reading verses 27 to 33. You see the title of the message this morning, if you have an outline, calling this Sacrificing Truth for the sake of convenience. Sacrificing truth for the sake of convenience. Mark chapter 11, we begin reading in verse 27. It says, they come again to Jerusalem, this is Jesus and his disciples, and as he was walking in the temple, there come to him the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. Now you remember, Jesus has come to Jerusalem. It looks like he goes out of Jerusalem every night, perhaps back to Bethany or somewhere close by, and comes back during the daytime. One of those occasions, perhaps the day before, he has cleansed the temple, which we talked about that a week or two ago. And now he's back again on this morning. Perhaps this is Thursday. I'm not sure what day it is. But the chief priests and the scribes and the elders come to him. In verse 28, and they say unto him, by what authority doest thou these things? Now, what things are they talking about? Probably cleansing of the temple. But I don't think we could limit it to that. It's probably that and probably all the other things that Jesus has been reported as having done. They ask him, by what authority do you do these things? But the most recent one that probably is on their mind is the day before when he cleansed the temple. And who gave thee this authority to do these things? Verse 29, and Jesus answered and said unto him, I will also ask of you one question, and answer me, and I will tell you by what authority I do these things. Now here's Jesus' question, verse 30. The baptism of John, was it from heaven or of men? Answer me. Verse 31, and they reasoned within themselves, saying, if we shall say from heaven, he will say, why then did you not believe him? But if we shall say of men, they feared the people, for all men counted John that he was a prophet indeed. And they answered and said unto Jesus, we cannot tell. And Jesus answering said unto them, neither do I tell you by what authority I do these things. When I was a kid, I've got a sister 2 years older than me. And when we were 8, 10, 12 years old, somewhere in that time frame, occasionally we would play Monopoly together. I don't know if, how many of you play Monopoly or how many of you like to play Monopoly. It's not on my list of things to do, hasn't been for a number of years. But when I was a kid, we used to play Monopoly. Now, we were eight. I was probably 8 to 10. She was 10 to 12. She was a couple years older than me. And there's a limit to how much an 8 or 10-year-old can understand about really how to play Monopoly. And I didn't have, and I don't think my sister did either, really understand what collateral meant, what interest was, some of these type things. So our rules by which we played Monopoly was sort of an abbreviated version. Now we didn't know that. We thought we knew what we was doing. But looking back on how we played Monopoly, it really was more true to how people live their life today than, I mean, it's kind of uncanny how the way we played Monopoly was how business people treat their financial life today. Let me give you some examples of how we played Monopoly. First of all, we didn't understand the rules. We were played the game, but we really didn't know what we were doing. We didn't understand about paying interest if we borrowed money. We didn't understand about if we borrowed money from the bank to put up, you had to put up collateral. We didn't know what that was or even how to do it. I was always the banker, and so consequently I always won. I didn't cheat though, I really didn't. We would spend our money every chance we got. When we started the game, you know, you start out with so much money. Every time we'd land on something, if it was something you could spend money on, we bought it. That's pretty the way people do things, isn't it? Spend your money every chance you get. We would land on, say I landed on St. James Place and I bought it. I could immediately put a hotel on it. I know that's not the way the rules were, but that's the way we did it. And if I didn't have enough cash to buy the motel, I'd borrow it from the bank. I had no other properties to put up for collateral. I just borrowed it. I just kept on a list there of what I was borrowing and borrowed the money. If I landed on something that she had and had to pay her rent and I didn't have the money, I borrowed the money. Well, occasionally, we would have questions of the rules. Now, who do you think was the authority between us two? Me? And she's 2 years older than I am. She's a female. I was handicapped, right? No, it wasn't her and it wasn't me. The authority was whoever on that particular day could get what they wanted from the other. Okay? If there was a dispute about the rules, and I said we could do this, and she said we could do that, and we were bickering about it, we knew neither one of us was the other person's boss. That was mom and dad. And we're bickering about it. I said, okay, I'm not playing. What did she want? She wanted to play. So in order to get what she wanted, she caved in to my demands. So whoever was authority could get what they wanted. They were the authority. They are the ones that made the rules. We would go around the board. You know, we could knew what to do. It was just a matter of who got the most motels and all this kind of stuff. You know how the game ended almost always? Usually it was my sister. We'd be bickering again about the rules, and she would say, just sweep everything off the board, and I would declare myself the winner. And it would take a week or so, and she'd be ready to take me on again. But I want you to think about this, about rules, and to think about truth. And when truth is not the foundation for what we do, whether it's playing Monopoly or whether it is real life. I also look at this text. I got three or four things that I want to tell you and share with you from this text. The first one is this. When truth has no value, then any authority other than my own is despised. When truth has no value, then any authority other than my own is despised. I hate it. I will not put up with it. Notice what these people are saying to Jesus. They come to Jesus and they say, "By what authority are you doing these things?" Notice that they are not denying his power. They are not denying the things that have been done. Too many blind people have been given their sight. Too many lame people have been made to walk. Too many deaf people now hear. Too many lepers have been cleansed. Too many sick people have been made well. They cannot deny his power. And they don't try to. They simply want to know, by what authority are you doing these things? The New Testament tells us that Jesus behaved. Jesus acted and gave the impression of one who had authority. It tells us that Jesus taught as one having authority. The people described him that way. In John 1:12, we see the verse, "To them gave he power to become the sons of God." Jesus had the authority to declare someone, to make someone a son of God. John chapter 5, verse 27, we see that the Father has given Jesus authority to execute judgment. These are Jesus' words. John 17:2, the high priestly prayer of Jesus. Jesus says that he was given the authority to give eternal life to all that the Father has given him. John chapter 10, Jesus says, "No man takes my life from me. I have the power, I have the authority to lay my life down. And I have the power, I have the authority to take it up again." Jesus taught as one having authority. Jesus behaved as one having authority. And Jesus declared that he had authority. Why then do these rulers ask him, "Who gave you this authority?" First of all, let's see how they got their own authority. They were scribes, they were rulers, they were elders, and they were given authority in a system much like we would do in church, in ordaining someone, giving someone a certain amount of authority or a limited authority within the church. They were picked out and chosen and ordained as rabbis, as scribes, as leaders, as elders among their people. And they ask Jesus, "By what sense or in what way or when were you given authority. What they are trying to do is something they had not been successful in doing. The Jews were given a limited amount of civil authority from the Romans, and they had been left with the authority within their own religion to exercise authority. If I'm not mistaken, one of the things that the Jewish people could do, and the leaders could do, is exercise capital punishment for certain things. One of those things was blasphemy. And they were attempting, it seems, to get Jesus to answer a question. It doesn't matter how he answered it. They thought they would be able to trick him and to trap him and to legally take him by force for answering a question that would be blasphemous toward God. Jesus has answered these questions before. I just read you several verses that tells that, declares that, shows that. And yet they had not been able to take hold on him. But now if they get him to publicly declare his authority comes from God, or he has authority within himself, then they'll be able to legally take him. Jesus doesn't walk into the trap that they're setting. These people have given truth, what is true, no value. And they despise any authority that Jesus may have or anyone else except their own. Number two, when a civilization is not grounded in truth, authority is much valued and much abused. When a civilization is not grounded in truth, authority is much valued and much abused. It is much valued because that is the means by which things get done. And it is much abused because we are sinful human beings. These rulers had the authority to take, the power to take life. I want you to think of that in terms of our modern political arena. I don't know if you have noticed this or not, but our nation is not a civilization, it is not a society that is grounded in truth. And as a result of that, we value authority. That is why presidential elections are important to Christians, because the authority of a president who thinks like we think is important to us. When there is no truth, you think of this for a minute, and I may not have thought this through, but if truth was laid out before us and before our nation, and everything, every step along the way for every situation was laid out before us, and truth is there, truth is exhaustive, and it is there, and we have to live by it, why would it matter who was president? But it's not that way. First place, everything is not laid out. And secondly, even if it were, we place no value on it. As a whole, our nation does not value truth. And so the person who has authority is the person who has the advantage. Whether it's a Supreme Court justice, that we say this president may have the opportunity to appoint two justices or three justices or whatever, or when the justices get to a certain number, then this law can be changed or that law can be changed. Why is it that we think that way? Because truth is not valued. And so the only alternative that we have is authority to put in place what our particular brand wants to be put in place. Number three, when truth is not the foundation of society, then truth is not considered. I want to give you a little background for the text right here of where we're at. In Luke chapter 19, and you can turn and read this sometime if you want, but this is the parallel account of Jesus cleansing the temple just the day before this, a day or two before this. And it says that the people were listening very attentively to him. They were hanging on to his every word as Jesus taught in the temple and in the synagogue. The fact that Jesus has just cleansed the temple did not run these people off. I don't know what they thought about that. They may have been cheering him on silently. I don't know. But it did not run them off. They were listening to him. They were hanging on to his every word. And in the midst of that kind of environment, these people come to Jesus with a trap, saying, "By what authority do you do this?" And Jesus responds to them with the question. "Let me ask you this," he says, "the baptism of John." In other words, was John sent from heaven, or was he just a man? Tell me that. And we see the reasoning of these people. And I'll ask you a question. At what point in their reasoning do they consider what is true? Nowhere. Nowhere that I can see. What they consider is, how will this make me look? What answer should I give to get what I want? They're going to answer and they're going to behave in such a way that it is convenient for them. Truth is never considered. What is right is not a consideration. It's simply, how am I going to answer this? If we say to him, "John was from heaven, God sent John," then he's going to answer, "Then why didn't you believe on him?" And it's worse than that. Because what was John's attitude toward Jesus? John said, "Behold, here he is, the Lamb of God, which takes away the sin of the world. Here is the Messiah." If they say John the Baptist was sent from heaven, Jesus will say, "Why didn't you believe him then? Why didn't you believe when he pointed to me?" We can't say that. When in that do they consider what is right? They don't. So we can't say he's from heaven. What if we say he's of men? Well, if we say John the Baptist was just a man, he was just a prophet, it wasn't sent from God, he was just some guy, some weird guy out in the wilderness. If we say that, there was nothing spiritual about it, nothing authoritative about his message. If we say that, then all these people around here who are hanging on to Jesus' every word, we know what they think of John the Baptist. They like him. They believe in him. They think he was from God. They thought he was sent from God. If we say no, he wasn't, they will be angry at us. They will not like us. They will despise us even more than they do already, perhaps. At what point there are they asking themselves, "But what is true?" They're not. Truth has been sacrificed for what will suit their purpose at the moment. They have no answer. The only thing they can say is, "We can't say." Perhaps more importantly or more truthful would be, "We won't say." And so much of the time, even in our day, I think that that is the way people reason. I have seen it on an individual basis. People do not consider what is right. They only want to know what will work, what will get me the desired end that I'm seeking. Whether it is right or not never enters the equation. That's what happens when truth is no longer a foundation for a society, for a civilization. Not only is it abused, it is forgotten. Has absolutely no value. And lastly, number four, when a person has no place for truth, he is often left in darkness. Here we're taking this individually, taking it personally. When a person has no place for truth, he is often left in darkness. They would not answer Jesus' question. They cared nothing for the truth. And so why does Jesus leave them? With no answer of their own. No answer of their own question. Neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things. Darkness. You know, I remember when I was in college, I remember a definition for darkness, the scientific definition for darkness. Pretty simple. The absence of light. Darkness is the absence of light. In Exodus chapter 10, this is something I just noticed last night and this morning. Exodus chapter 10, when God had sent the plagues upon Pharaoh and the Egyptians. Wasn't it 10 plagues? For some reason I was doubting the number there. 10 plagues, is that right? 10 plagues, the last one was the killing of the firstborn, right? What was the next to the last one? Anybody ever memorize those in order? I didn't either. The next to the last one was darkness was sent on the land for 3 days. Okay, now I want you to turn to Exodus chapter 10. We're going to read something that stood out to me and never had before. Exodus chapter 10. My Bible has some headings. I'm going to go back. They may not be all listed here. The plagues. The water becomes blood. The plague of frogs. The lice come. Swarms of flies. The animals die. The boils on their bodies. The plague of hail. Locusts. And now 3 days of darkness. Exodus chapter 10, verse 21. Let's read this together. The Lord said unto Moses, stretch out thine hand toward heaven, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt. What's that next phrase say? Even darkness which may be felt. Now I acknowledge that that might be an analogy. But I want to tell you something. Have you ever been somewhere where it is dark, and it's dark, but you can make a distinction between things? You may not be able to tell that this is a Dodge truck, but you know it's not a bicycle because of the darkness. You know what I'm saying? You can see there's an object there. That's not darkness. If you can distinguish between anything, there is light present. That is not the absence of light. We say it is dark. Every night, it never gets absolutely dark. There is always light. We have a couple of night lights around our place just to see. Occasionally, every 10 years or so, they'll go out. And when they go out, it seems awfully dark. But it's not dark. It is not, it may be darker than it is at noontime the next day, but it's not absolutely dark. If you are in a cave or wherever you may be, and you can see anything at all, you may can see your hand in front of your face barely, or maybe you can't hardly. That's not darkness. Can you imagine what it is like to be in such a place that you cannot see anything? I mean, nothing. I think that is why this phrase is used, even a darkness that could be felt. It seems so thick and so heavy and so black. Verse 22. And Moses stretched forth his hand to heaven, and there was a thick darkness in all the land of Egypt 3 days. Notice the adjectives that's described. Thick darkness. They saw not one another. Neither rose any from his place for 3 days. Now, I tend to think this is a little more close to literal than I've ever looked at this before. When it is that dark, what can you do? I suspect the darkness was so thick and so felt among them that when it says they rose not from their place, that may mean exactly what it means. They did not get up and walk or feel their way through the house. It was so dark. Verse 24, and all the children of Israel had light in their dwellings. And Pharaoh called unto Moses and said, Go ye serve the Lord, only let your flocks and your herds be stayed, let your little ones also go with you. And Moses said, Thou must give us also sacrifices and burnt offerings that we may sacrifice unto the Lord our God. Our cattle also shall go with us, there shall not be a hoof be left behind. For thereof must we take to serve the Lord our God, and we know not with what we must serve the Lord until we come thither. But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let them go. Now notice verse 28. And Pharaoh said unto him, Get thee from me, take heed to yourself, see my face no more. For in the day you see my face, you will die. This is something new. I don't think in any of the other 8 plagues that preceded this, Pharaoh has said this. I didn't look back at all of them. I did several of them. Most of the other ones, Pharaoh says, okay, I give up. I change my mind. Please ask God to take the flies away, and then we'll let you do what you want to do. So Moses entreats God. God takes the flies away, and everything's back to normal, and Pharaoh changes his mind. God sends the locusts. Pharaoh says, okay, I give up. Please get these locusts out of here, and I'll let you do what you want to do. God sends the hail and the lightning and the storms. Pharaoh says, okay, I give up. I quit. I give in. I see. You can go. God takes it all away. He changes his mind. This time, it's different. He says, if I ever see you again, Moses, I will kill you. Don't come back to me again. Over what? Darkness. Darkness. I would have thought the flies would have been enough for me to set me on off. Right? Or the boils. I'm a pretty big baby when I get physically something wrong with me, according to some people. But darkness, There is something about this darkness that Pharaoh has met his limit. If you come back again, I will kill you. I don't know if it's as much or only the darkness as it is what God did to Pharaoh. Pharaoh did not want light. Pharaoh did not want truth. Pharaoh did not want to let the children of Israel go and do what God told them to do. Maybe God has met his limit. He places Pharaoh in darkness, a darkness from which he will not recover. This is it for Pharaoh. The next plague is the firstborn. You can obviously see a spiritual parallel there. A total inability to see. I want you to think just for a moment about spiritual darkness. Spiritual darkness, a darkness that is so thick that it can be felt. A darkness that is so real that it can be seen. In a darkness that it is so final and so absolute that it is a horror. Perhaps we know people. I wouldn't tell you for sure I knew somebody, because you never know what God is going to do in people's heart. But there are people that we have seen, we have witnessed, that seem so antagonistic toward God that the darkness seems so thick. When a person has no place for truth in their heart and in their life, it just may be that God leaves them in darkness, a thick, utter darkness that can be felt. You remember what happened when Jesus was crucified? Several things happened, supernatural things, right? Earthquake. Graves were opened. That would have been got your attention, wouldn't it? And darkness. You know, I have heard explained that through astronomy that they can see, you know, when eclipses occur and all this kind of stuff. And not only can they predict when they'll occur now, but they can run that cycle backwards. And someone has suggested that there was an eclipse happened in the area of Jerusalem and the Middle East there about the time that Jesus was crucified. You know, that's well and good, but I doubt if that's the kind of darkness it was. I doubt if it was just near darkness that eclipse may give us. When Jesus was crucified and darkness came at noonday, I suspect it was thick. It was a darkness like we're talking about. Take heed to yourself that this type of darkness come not upon you. Let's pray. God, apart from you, Lord, that's where we all would end up. God, even as these scribes and elders of the Jewish people. Did not really want truth. God, it ought to frighten us how possible that is for us. God, I acknowledge that apart from your intervening grace in my heart, that's where I would be. Same is true for any child of God. And God, we lift our hearts, we lift our faces to you in gratitude. Lord, that you have redeemed us. You have brought us from darkness into light. God, help us to value truth. Amen.